Mr. Flynn and Mr. Burke, welcome to the Supreme Court. The first case today is case number 69353, Miller versus Miller. Mr. Flynn for the appellant, Mr. Burke for the respondent. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Chief Justice Cherry. May it please the court, Jack Flynn for the appellant, Leslie Lynn Miller. This case presents an issue of first impression in our state, and that issue is how courts should calculate child support when parties have a split custody arrangement. In this case, the parties stipulated to their custodial timeshare, and the court adopted that stipulation as an order of the court. Specifically, the parties agreed that with respect to the timeshare of their daughter, Peyton, that Mrs. Miller would be the primary physical custodian, with Mr. Miller getting 2 out of every 14 days on a regular basis, as well as Father's Day, part of the child's birthday, and then 2 weeks of uninterrupted vacation if he chose in the summer. This is a maximum timeshare of 66 days per year, and the visitation for dad would be 18%. That gives mom 82% of the time with the minor child, Peyton. With respect to the party's son, Jordan, the parties agreed to label the custodial designation as joint physical custody, with Mr. Miller getting 5 out of every 14 days on a regular basis, plus Father's Day, part of the child's birthday, and then the same 2 weeks of uninterrupted vacation if he so chose in the summer. This timeshare provides Mr. Miller with a maximum of 141 days of visitation per year, or 39% of the time, giving Mrs. Miller 61% of the time with the minor child, Jordan. Despite being able to reach an agreement on child custody, the parties were unable to work out child support, and so that issue is the single issue submitted to the court, and the court took the issue under advisement after a prove-up hearing. The information that the court had at the time with respect to the parties' income and household expenses is only found in the parties' financial disclosure forms, which are on file. At the time, Mrs. Miller was a billing clerk for an eye doctor, and she made $3,986.66 per month, with stated expenses of approximately $5,000 per month. Mr. Miller's income as an office manager for a tow company was similar to Mrs. Miller's at $4,304.97 per month, but his expenses were greatly reduced compared to Mrs. Miller's, and his expenses were stated to be $3,158.08 per month. Using those numbers, the district court awarded Mrs. Miller $345 per month in child support. The court did not issue any specific findings as to how it arrived at that amount, but the amount was essentially 8% of Mr. Miller's gross monthly income. Because of the lack of findings and the lack of clarity as to how the district court reached its determination, Mrs. Miller filed a motion for reconsideration and/or to amend the judgment. There was a hearing held on that issue, and the district court recognized that there was a lack of uniformity among at least the 8th Judicial District Court judges on how to calculate split custody child support. The court asked this court if this matter were to be appealed for some direction with that, in that regard. But the court maintained its order and stated that it was complying with the statutory amounts of 25% and 18%, but still did not explain how the calculus was done. The court noted that there were also some allowable deviations that the court had factored in, but did not set forth any specific findings of fact as to what those were.
Mr. Cook, can I ask you a question? Sure. I know you do a lot of family law and all. We're getting a lot of cases where there's no findings, but when they have to, there has to be findings under the law. Is it something the attorneys ask the judges, say, judge, please, you got to do findings, especially if the case is going to be appealed and all. What happened, like in this case here, that the judge didn't do the findings at all?
Well, initially in this case, I drafted the order, and I was told just leave a blank for the child support. So there were no findings, and that's understandable. But on the motion for reconsideration, I specifically asked the court, can I get some findings on this? And the court set forth the finding that it was in the best interest of the child and that it was in compliance with the statute, but didn't provide the exact calculus.
So how he did the deviation, you know, like that, he didn't show how he came up
right.
with that
Right. He said, I think he explicitly stated on the record, I didn't bring the paperwork or my calculations with me to the bench.
Counsel, in this particular regard, since you said this is a matter of first impression and so on, from your standpoint, and since our law is not totally clear on that issue, what considerations do you think the court should make in calculating?
Sure. I think under our laws, the court recognizes that the statutory percentage is the presumed basic needs of the child. So I think the court needs to look at the case law and the rationale behind the child support statute, why it's there. This court has done that in Barbagallo and Wright v. Osborne in a number of cases. In Barbagallo, in Garrett, the court stated that the amount is presumed to meet the basic needs of the child. Earlier in Barbagallo, the court stated that a primary parent has fixed expenses and those aren't appreciably diminished when the non-custodial parent has more of the timeshare. So I think the court needs to look at that policy consideration of it's difficult because my inclination would be that the district court needs to have discretion in this area because the deviation factors are allowed, but as a practical matter, because I do practice family law life a lot, they follow the case law that says the deviations are the exception. So
I'm asking you that question because you're saying the court made no findings. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking back and say if we remanded back to the court to make findings, what specific findings of the split custody situation do you think the court should make?
Well, I think the court needs direction before it's going to possibly be able to make findings.
So what is your view, counsel, of the amicus briefs filed in this case and the approach offered by the family law section of the state bar?
I disagree with the amicus briefs calculation. They propose that you take the obligation of each parent based on the number of children. So in this case, Mrs. Miller, because she has joint physical custody of one child, would have an 18% obligation. Whereas Mr. Miller, because he has joint physical custody as a non-custodial parent of the other child, would be 25%. The problem with that sort of calculation is it doesn't factor in the rationale behind the child support statute, which is to meet the basic needs of the children, and that 18% is the presumptive basic need for one child. So in this case, it says, Mrs. Miller, your obligation is 18% for one child. Mr. Miller, for two children, it's 25%. That places a greater premium on the joint physical custody arrangement. And in fact, it makes Mrs. Miller's obligation for one child 1.5 times greater than Mr. Miller's is for each of his children because he's doing 12.5 and 12.5. The problem with that, and I think it's illustrated by the facts in this case, are that when you do that, you end up with a party, Mrs. Miller, who has one child who would get 18% if that was the only child, and then you're including another child in her household when she actually has about 61% of the time with that child and saying, we're going to reduce her child support down now by about 10%, even though she now has that second child in there because Mr. Miller also has joint physical custody. It's a difficult situation, but I don't think that that proposal is correct. I think there's three other possible formulas that make much more sense under the statutory scheme. And I can kind of go through those. I have one that I think is probably the most proper.
What's your preferred? We canvassed Alaska, Illinois, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Is your preferred connected to any of them?
Not that I'm aware of. Wisconsin is kind of a proration with the 12.5 and 12.5. That is one of the three that I think makes sense under our statutory scheme, given the 25% for two children. And I think it takes in the equities of the situations with most parents and kind of says, okay, for each child, it's going to be about 12.5% in this type of split custody situation. It's difficult. My preferred method would be to calculate the primary first, which would be 18% for one child, and then do Wright v. Osborne on the remaining 7% from the 25 to the 18%. And that places more emphasis on the primary custodian because that person is going to have more fixed expenses just because of that primary relationship, especially in the facts of this case where Mrs. Miller has 82% of the time with that child and 61% of the time with the other.
My only concern about that is where you have a shared custody arrangement like this, those fixed expenses really exist in both households. So it's really troublesome to me to arrange or set up a formula that seems to account for greater emphasis on the Barbagallo reasoning. It doesn't really work. I don't think those undefined but perceived fixed expenses exist in both households.
Well, I think our statutory scheme,
and just because one parent might have, lower rent than the other parent, they have rent.
Right.
They have power bills and so forth.
Sure. I think our statute recognizes that the fixed expenses are higher in a primary household because there are no offsets in a primary physical custody situation. It's a straight 18%. So in this case, sure, dad is going to have fixed expenses for his visitation time, but the statute doesn't take that into account. I think those matters are best dealt with on the deviation factors that the court has discretion. In this case, the parties make almost the same amount of money. So what's happening here is when all is said and done, Mrs. Miller at the end of the day is getting about $400 more per month. She's getting $300. Under the family law section, they're saying give her $358 per month. But with her expenses, as stated on the record and in evidence, she's way upside down compared to Mr. Miller. And Mr. Miller has stated his expenses are not nearly what hers are. So the court could have factored that in terms of deviation.
What did you think? Did you evaluate the approach taken in Alaska?
I don't believe I looked at that approach.
I have a question, and it doesn't exonerate us from needing to provide guidance in this area, but to what extent is this issue addressed statutorily in most other states? You know, I mean, we're being called on to devise factors and apply them here because our statute is not helpful in this arena particularly. And a lot of the other jurisdictions seem to have statutes specifically addressing this that we don't. And I don't know whether we're alone or are we one of a few or is this a significant number of states that the legislature hasn't addressed this?
And I focus pretty much on the five that are income.
That are similar to ours, yeah.
They're similar to ours. And Wisconsin seemed to be the most similar with the 25% and the proration.
But it's an awkward fit with our case law.
Right, it's an awkward fit for us. I don't know that any state, and I apologize, I don't recall. I probably didn't ask a long time ago, but I don't recall what it is.
Okay, thanks.
But I would also note, just, I'm sure the court is aware that the legislature has repealed 125B070 and 080 pending the commission that's going to be appointed coming up with new guidelines. I don't know when that's going to happen. I'm hopeful that this will all be worked out through then, but we don't know what is going to happen. So hopefully the statutory...
So what's the status of that?
There's a commission that's being appointed. This is a different issue. I kind of think the legislature delegated its authority.
And this is under that umbrella?
Right. Well, it may be. It depends on what that commission decides to do. When they come up with the new statutory scheme, they may factor in what happens in split custody.
They're to report at the next legislative session on...
I don't think it needs to pass the next legislative session according to the language. I think it just comes into effect as soon as the commission adopts it.
It's the Child Support Guideline Committee.
Right, they're going to be completely different.
Mr. Fleeman, shouldn't it just be reversed and remanded? And before we give guidance, shouldn't we actually know what the judge was thinking and what calculations he made? I mean, for us to be asked to give guidance here, the guidance is supposed to come when we get an order that explains to us what he was thinking. So should it just be reversed and remanded and ask the judge to make findings, explain how you did your math, and it may be that once those findings come back, that makes sense, or it's not an abuse of discretion, and we don't need to engage in creating statute, essentially creating law here as it relates to something that I think is most clearly, at least in my research, left to statute. And left to legislatures.
Well, in this case, the difficulty in me saying yes, it should be reversed and just remanded for further findings is that when we did go back on a motion for reconsideration to amend the court, I was asked for findings and specifically asked this court for, if it were to go up, for direction because he did not know what formula to use. I agree it probably would have been better if the judge had put on the record specifically, this is what I did, and I asked for that, but it wasn't given to me. Aside from just it being frustrating for my client if that were to happen, I do think that there's a need for predictability and uniformity, and that's why I would ask this court to provide direction. The court kind of did that in Wright v. Osborne and looked at the situation and looked at what it had done in Barbagallo before and said, we need some predictability and uniformity, and we can look at the legislative background of the statute and kind of say, this is what is supposed to happen, so we're going to come up with a formula. So I think the court has done it before. I think the court could do it now, and I think it would make sense in this case rather than seeing what the judge would do in the meantime, other judges are going to continue to do a multitude of things across the state, so I think it's necessary.
You have about 29 seconds left. You want to reserve any?
I don't think I'm going to be able to respond with 27 seconds, so if the court has any other questions, I'll just use the time then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christopher Burke for the respondent. I won't take that long, so if counsel wanted to use some of my time in rebuttal, more than welcome. Permitted. I would ask that the district court's decision get affirmed for three reasons. The court didn't just make up a number. The court did give how it generally came up with this figure, and it did put in a deviation factor about the time sharing. And third, the court looked at it twice. So what we're going to do is send it back down, and the court's just going to say, here's my numbers. And the irony is, Mr. Fleeman had a chance at court to say, I need specific numbers. But instead, when the court gave him the opportunity, because if we look at page 135 and 136, the court says, and then I run the deviation factors after the court talks about the 18 and 25%. Actually, I'll read the whole thing if the court will indulge me. Okay, page 135. Line 23. Essentially, how I run those calculations is I take a look at the 18% calculation and the 25% calculation, look at the comparative incomes of the parties, and then I run the deviation factors under 0.080 in order to get me to a number that I think is appropriate given all the circumstances that the parties present to me, as well as the custodial arrangement. Mr. Fleeman, okay. It wasn't, well, I need exact numbers, Judge. Next line, not a formula by the court, not a formula as I'm prohibited from using a formula at that point, but yeah, hopefully that's sufficient to get you there. Mr. Fleeman, okay. In other words, we're wasting time and money that Mr. Miller doesn't have. In fact, he came to me as a pro bono appeal, and so he doesn't have money to go back into district court, and then it gets sent back up here so the court can figure out a formula. The point is this, the court can affirm on the record it has. The court didn't abuse its discretion. It gave generally how it figured out the number, and the numbers work out as laid out in my brief, 18%, 7% difference, the 25% for the second child came out to about $350 a month, and that's what the amicus brief also says. So the point is, in the end, we're going to be coming up with the same number of about $350. The court can still affirm.
Counsel, I respect what you're saying, and I have deep empathy for the parties who are put in a position to come to go through the time and expense and delay of an appeal to the Supreme Court over an issue like this where the amounts involved are at least not on the surface all that substantial. But on the other hand, I read this entire record, and I beg to differ with you that what the court's description of what it's doing or is thinking, as you just recited, complies in any way with Anastatis or Jackson. I mean, how is this court supposed to review what he said just as you recounted it?
Well, I gave the best two lines, maybe it was, that on how he calculated. If that's not sufficient, it's not sufficient.
Right.
The point, though, goes beyond
that. What makes it hard, though, is that if you look at some of the calculations that are being advocated by the other side, that might be drawn from the amicus brief, that might be looked at from other states. I mentioned Alaska. Council mentioned Wisconsin, Illinois, and others have tackled this issue. It's a couple hundred, maybe $300 more per month, maybe even $400 more per month. That's quite a bit.
Assuming
to these parties. Assuming that the court was interested in going down that road.
But assuming also that the income's the same.
That, and it might have to be entirely revisited if it were sent back on remand. Maybe the party's circumstances, financial circumstances, have changed, in which case it should be revisited in any event. But at the end of the day, when the district court's enter an explanation like that, it makes it almost impossible for this court to review that calculation consistent with what we have said. Anastatis says, the district court's failure to set forth findings of fact as to the basis for deviation constitutes reversible error.
Now, except that your point was, as I understand from the transcript you read, and part of it's in your brief, that your opponent affirmatively weighed more in the way of findings from the district court than were given. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying twofold. I'm arguing the court gave enough. I understand
Your
Honor doesn't think so. But I think with what he gave, the numbers worked.
We get this in other settings, too, from family court, that without making a decision, they would like us to weigh in. And that's very difficult, where they say, well, it would be helpful if someone would run an appeal, but we don't have anything to review if we don't have good findings. By the same token, I'm questioning you on the waiver, and I'm sorry I interrupted you. I wanted to...
No, not at all. And in fact, that's my point. Mr. Fleeman had the opportunity, and in fact, I'll even give a third quote by him, when he says, so the court says on page 135, line 15, so, this is the court, so I'm presuming those are sufficient findings for you to be able to do what you need to do from this point, Mr. Fleeman. Response by Mr. Fleeman, yeah, in terms of the record, I'm not sure what the calculations are. I don't know if it's necessary for the record how the court calculates that. In other words, now we got to go back to recalculate. When he could have said, no, it's not sufficient. I need it. I want to take it up. I'm going to appeal it, and I need to know the numbers. But he didn't.
That's an obligation of the judge, to make written factual findings and to explain his reasoning such that it's capable of review.
But an attorney can ask if it's not sufficient. The judge should have. If you consider it not sufficient, and I'm not sure I do, but I guess that doesn't matter. But the point is, if it's not sufficient, say it. That's not sufficient. I need numbers, Judge. I'm taking it up. Instead, he waives it. It's okay. I'm fine. I guess that's good enough. And now here we are in this court, so I'm not sending it back down to get the numbers to come back up here to find a formula.
Subsequent to these oral pronouncements at the hearing, did the court prepare a written order? And findings of fact?
It was prepared by counsel, and counsel didn't object to leave a blank where the judge would put in a number. And then he asked for his motion to reconsider, and the judge said, yeah, my calculations are the same. So there's almost no chance he's going to re-change his numbers.
But actually, what were his calculations? I mean, it's completely conclusory. He talks about other departments doing it differently, but never says what they are in fact doing.
Well, yes, he does. He says he takes the 18% of their incomes and the 25%. And then he took in the deviation on the timeshare. Now, did he put specific numbers in there? No, but when we look at my brief and the amicus, the numbers make sense with what he came up with, about $350. Take 18% of both income, and then he took 7% on the parent who had to pay custody for two children. And the difference was about $350. And so what am I asking is the court to affirm, and the court can still come up with a formula.
Was there any argument in district court citing case law that the findings of the district court judge are inadequate under the statutory obligation to make adequate findings? Was that argued in the motion for reconsideration by your opponent?
Again, I'm just doing the appeal, but in reading the brief of the appellant, I believe he did ask for more findings.
In the court?
Yes, in his motion to reconsider. But when it came time to pull the trigger on that...
He threw in the towel, is your point?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I'm saying he shouldn't be rewarded and got a third bite at the apple, and Mr. Miller shouldn't be penalized for this. Because what's going to happen, he can't afford an attorney. And probably just pro bono, I'll be down there to do it because I've started this, or I agreed to jump in.
Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. It's a good program. It's worthwhile. Yeah. And I appreciate that it was set up. But the point is, we're spinning our wheels. So the court comes, we go back down, the court says, here's how I did it. 345 again. Then what? Then we're back up here to figure out the formula? It just seems like a waste of time and effort and money. And I would ask the court to affirm on the record that's here, either because the court below did give sufficient findings, or the counsel waived the opportunity to request more when the court said, is that sufficient? Okay, okay. And the court, again, can still come up with a formula.
I think it'll be a good issue for the Child Support Commission. But it was Judge Hoskins, correct?
Yes.
And that's the presiding judge down at the family court. And he did use 18% and 25% and did say there was a timeshare. He used the timeshare. So what more findings would you think he could make?
None. I think it was sufficient.
If he'd used 17% and 24%, you know, then we'd have some type of error. But there seems to be no error as far as the percentages that he used. He followed the statute, 18 and 25, and some considerations for timeshare.
Yes, and also he did talk about health insurance.
So, counsel, you're much closer to the facts in the case. Using what he described he did, can you replicate his number?
I did in my appeal brief. It came within $13 of what he came up with, and so the deviation factor may have been the difference. Yeah. And it's also what the amicus brief came.
And that approach, as you described in that brief, raises the question as to whether or not it's appropriate given the approaches taken to hybrid custody questions throughout the country.
I think that amicus hit the nail on the head when it said you're always going to have cases that look unjust in the end, but you need something to get the majority in line. And I think that the formula, the amicus, and that I proposed would get us there and get us generally to take care of most of the cases.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me give you a couple minutes to respond since counsel was so generous as to leave you some time. Take 2 minutes.
I appreciate that. Just to clarify a couple of things in terms of the motion for reconsideration, it was noted in there that the court's decision with respect to the $345 per month child support amount is not supported with findings or conclusion of law which are necessary to demonstrate the sufficient evidence to support the number.
Two minutes is longer than that. If you just slow down just a little bit, so keep up with that. Right. I'm sorry.
Okay. It was included in the motion for reconsideration and noted to the court that it was not supported by sufficient facts or conclusions of law, the number.
But the court was, sorry, go ahead.
Just on the outset, I know the father appeared pro se to begin with in the first hearing. Did he appear pro se in the reconsideration where you again prepared the order?
Yes. Yes, he did.
And you prepared the first order for the district judge that you were then moving to reconsider as containing insufficient findings. Correct?
Yes, because it was prepared as a stipulated decree, and the only answer he didn't have was the child support, so that was the only thing that was left blank.
Yeah.
Everything else was stipulated.
I understand that.
In terms of the waiver, I would argue I didn't waive the issue. I stated, in terms of the record, I'm not sure what the calculations are. I don't know if it's necessary for the record how the court calculates, and then I was cut off. And it shows that in the transcript, and the court said, I would love to give you the exact calculations, but I don't have my notes when I did it. That's what the court said. The court also did not, that I recall and that I can see in the record, make a deviation for timeshare or health insurance. Health insurance was a factor completely separate from the child support here, so there is no deviation for health insurance. And a deviation for timeshare, honestly, if it were there, and I don't think it is, wouldn't even make sense in this case, because mom has 82% of the time with one child and 61% of the time with the other child. So the deviation, I don't know how that would even come into play, or there's no findings on it. It is part of the problem, obviously, for the court. So I think that's pretty much all my time, and I hope that clarified a couple of things.
Well, thanks to both counsel for this matter. I think you both were very clear in your positions, and this matter will stand submitted. And I think we're in recess till 11:30.